Well, the 1800s, particularly following the period of the Civil War, is a time of a lot of upheaval in our country. There's a lot of political unrest. There's a lot of social unrest. Part of it revolved around slavery. Part of it revolved around differences in the economy that you saw in the North and what you saw in the South. The South is basically rural and very agricultural. Most of the industry, and we didn't have a lot of industry in the 1800s, but most of the industry is centralized in the North. And so there are a lot of things that are at play here. It's not just the economy, it's the way that people lived. If you lived in the South, you probably lived on a farm, and it was fairly easy to incorporate other people into your family because you always had work for them to do. If you were looking at the North, it was not so easy to incorporate people into your family because you probably lived in a very small apartment, and it wasn't take your daughters to work day. That it was just a lot harder in some ways in the North than it was in the South. But most of the wealth, especially in the period right after the war, is concentrated in the North. So the Civil War and Reconstruction and the regional and cultural differences that are created there play into division that begins to happen in this movement that Stone and Campbell and Kelly or O'Kelly have kind of fostered. A new generation of leadership emerges just prior to, during, and after the war. So the old guard, the ones that started all of this, are dying. And if they're not dying, they're at a point in their life where they're not able to do as much as they were able to do before. America's millennial hope is fading. Most of the thought in the period before the Civil War, kind of at the beginning of this restoration, centered around the idea that if we could unite all of God's people, that would be the precipitating factor in establishing the millennium, in establishing the God's rule. Now, I disagree with that. I think God is ruling now. I think he was ruling then. I think he ruled before that. But their thought process was that the Americas represented the last place where you could establish a Christian kingdom, a Christian nation, where everybody could be united together. That they'd pretty much given up on Europe. There was a lot of fussing and fighting in Europe, but in America, they thought that they could bring everybody together. And for the most part, this Stone, Campbell, O'Kelly movement was accomplishing that. But it begins to fade because there begins to be division within the ranks of this movement. Okay. I am still sharing. There you go. So around 1855, that's the first instance that I've been able to find of instruments being introduced into Churches of Christ. The first one that I found was 1855, and it was the 6th Street Church in Cincinnati, Ohio. There's a story about the time when the instrument was introduced to the church in Midway, Kentucky. And we'll talk about a story. I don't know exactly how true it is, but the bringing in of instruments was kind of accompanied by a change in the way that the churches began to view themselves. The 1800s and kind of up to the Civil War period, most of the churches were pretty plain Jane buildings. They were little more than log cabins. They weren't big, they weren't grand. And initially on the frontier, there really wasn't a question about whether you'd have an instrument, because for the most part, you didn't have the economic foundation to be able to afford an instrument. Now, eventually, the argument progressed to a discussion of authority, but in the beginning, this was an issue of economics and kind of the social status of churches. This is something that Alexander Campbell wrote in 1851. He was responding to someone who made the observation that the introduction of a piano or a melodeon or some kind of an instrument would help to improve the singing, because the singing was really, for the most part, pretty bad. But Alexander Campbell said, "I presume to all spiritually minded Christians that such aids would be like a cowbell in a concert." And maybe that was true. This was the way that they felt about it. Well, 1859, Midway, Kentucky, L.L. Pinkerton, who is owned a sizable piece of land, was fairly prosperous farmer in that region, opined that the singing in the church in Midway was so bad that it scared the rats from worship. And so what he did was kind of surreptitiously, he moved a melodeon in. Well, in just very short order, another man who felt like there was no reason to have this melodeon, who was kind of the opinion that that Campbell was, the story is that he broke into the church building and he passed that piano or melodeon out through a window to one of his hired hands. And then in 1931, the Woodford Sun newspaper printed an article that was entitled "The Melodeon with a History." Briefly describes the turmoil in the congregation. According to the story, Adam Hibber, that was the farmer's name who didn't like the instrument, removed what he called an instrument of Satan on one winter night. Under cover of darkness, they had passed the melodeon out through a window. The whereabouts of the melodeon were uncertain for several decades until somebody found it. And it was in a barn that belonged to one of the descendants of Hibber. And that melodeon is on display at Midway College. And it's the melodeon with a with a past. This was what Ben Franklin wrote. He said, these refined gentlemen, and that was probably a not so subtle dig at people that felt like the singing was really bad and they wanted to improve it by using an instrument. These refined gentlemen have refined ears and enjoy fine music manufactured for French theaters, interspersed with short prayers and very short sermons. That was Ben Franklin in 1860. And Franklin is one of the publishers of an influential paper. Isaac Garrett also published an influential journal about that time. He said, we shall advise our brethren everywhere for the sake of peace to discard the use of instruments. That was kind of a middle ground. Some people wanted to bring it in. Some people thought that it was an unwarranted introduction. And Eric was arguing, even if you wanted to bring it in and it was okay, it would just do nothing more than cause friction. So it ought to be avoided for that reason. Well, the three big journals, the three influential newspapers that are published by members of or adherents to the Stone Campbell sort of position, was the American Christian Missionary or American Christian Review that was published by Ben Franklin, the Christian Standard that was published out of Cincinnati by Isaac Garrett, and the Gospel Advocate, which was published by David Lipscomb out of Nashville. Well, there are a lot of stories about how the instrument was introduced in 1886, in Springfield, Missouri. The church voted 121-68 to bring in an organ. The trustees that held the title to the building as the trustees of the church opposed the idea, and the congregation divided. You could pretty much understand what was going on. Thorpe Springs, Texas, the church divided over instrumental music. The congregation supported a small school. And after the division, the school moved to Waco and then back down to Fort Worth. And that school became TCU, or Texas Christian University. Those that were left behind in Thorpe Springs that did not want the instrument established what they called Thorpe Springs Christian College, which eventually became Abilene Christian College, Christian University, ACU. This is a picture of what many of it, this give you an idea of what many of the schools and churches looked like back then. They were pretty rough buildings. They were pretty plain. They just basically gave you some shelter from the hot noonday sun and a little bit of shelter from the rain. This is a commentary that Foster and Holloway wrote about the introduction of the instrument. And they had this to say, and there's some validity to this, perhaps because it was so visible, it became so divisive. You could worship for years with a congregation and not know which members in that congregation disagreed with your position on the missionary society. Remember we talked about the American Christian Missionary Society. Some people favored it, some people opposed it. And those people could worship together because in many ways you didn't know whether your friend sitting on the other end of the pew opposed it or was in favor of it. But the instrument was immediately visible. One could see immediately upon entering a building whether or not that congregation used instrumental music. And that there's some validity to that. That may be why the instrument was such a cause of division in the movement. In Cincinnati, Ohio, the Central Christian Church had assembled enough funds that they built a building that you see there on the screen. It was a beautiful building, stained glass, looked like many of the cathedrals that you would see in Europe. Not as grand as Notre Dame, but not anything like what they were generally speaking used to seeing. So that the church is kind of moving uptown. They build this new French Gothic style building in 1872. It seated 2,000. So this notion that the mega churches are a recent development is really not true. This building seated 2,000 in Cincinnati, Ohio in 1872. That's a big building. Had an organ, had a choir pit. At the time, it cost the outrageous sum of $140,000. This is what Benjamin Franklin said about that building. A mighty torrent of worldliness is now perverting and corrupting the pure and holy worship prescribed and authorized by our Lord Jesus Christ. So the argument is that this building is just, it's a worldly thing. So let me stop here for a minute. Has anybody else ever subconsciously made the decision as you're driving around and you encounter a building that says Church of Christ on the outside on the sign? Has anybody else ever said, well, that must be the quote-unquote anti-group because it's just a pretty poor-looking building, and you see a really nice, pretty brick building, and you think, well, those guys don't care much about biblical authority. Has anybody else ever kind of subconsciously done that when you're driving around? I have. And I've made it into a joke.
No, but Dick and I have gone into buildings and sat down, and then all of a sudden it says Church of Christ on the outside, and all of a sudden there was music in it, and it just wasn't comfortable, and we got up and went and found another congregation.
Okay. I was in Gunderson, Colorado, hunting, and I purposely came down the mountain to attend services in Gunderson. I was the only one waiting, and it was a regular building.
A regular building? What do you mean?
It was a plain Jane building. Nothing stood out.
But none of the people were there.
None of the regular members?
None whatsoever.
Huh.
That happened in Cody.
That happened also in Cody, Wyoming. We, on vacation, we were going, coming home to Oregon, and we purposely mapped out our trip back to be at Cody at 5 o'clock. Again, nobody showed up. But well, us.
Lenny, you need to take a shower more often.
Then again, when I hunted up in Oregon, up in the Blues, I went to a congregation there, and they welcomed us with open arms.
Yeah. I know when I was preaching in Brookings, the opening day of honey season, I was the only guy that was there in Brookings. So I led the song, yeah. I led the prayers, I served the Lord's Supper, I preached, and they had a huge bass section over in the church in Bend, because everybody had gone over there to go hunting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing happens. I don't think there's any reason why churches, I can understand that we're not trying to build some sort of a beautiful edifice. But I can't see any reason why we need to let our church buildings look like they've been neglected. I think you need to take care of it. I think it needs to look nice from the outside. Well, anyway.
Say, Dean, before you go on, when you look at these comments these individuals made, this fellow Ben Franklin was the only one that basically used scripture.
That's true.
And that, everybody else used their own opinion.
Yeah, that was my point. This, the original opposition to this was an economic opposition and kind of a social opposition. You guys think you're better than us, kind of thing. It was not until almost the 1900s that people began to talk about biblical authority as it related to using an instrument in the worship. And we developed an argument that it really comes from three particular passages. Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, and 1 Corinthians. And the interesting thing about it is Ephesians and Colossians don't have anything to do with the worship. It says, if you read Ephesians, he says, don't be drunk with wine wherein is excess, but be filled with the Spirit. And then he talks about singing. But that's Ephesians and Colossians are not talking about what happens in the assembly. And if anything, they talk about what's going on outside of the assembly. 1 Corinthians, the 14th chapter, talks about what's happening in the assembly. And in 1 Corinthians 14, it is singing. The Apostle Paul says, I would sing. So I never have been able to divine or to understand what the relationship is to the public assembly in Ephesians and Colossians. I understand it in 1 Corinthians, but we've kind of adopted a thought process that came from something that was a mistake in the first place. And that's unfortunate. If we're going to be consistent, Ephesians 5 and Colossians would indicate that we would never sing spiritual songs to accompaniment. And I know some people who have taken that position, that they never sing spiritual songs with any kind of accompaniment. They always sing spiritual songs a cappella, not just in the assembly, but they always do that. And to me, that seems a better interpretation of Ephesians and Colossians than to say that those are restricted to the assembly. First Corinthians is assembly. But anyway, this is kind of the development of the argument. This was the Christian standard. This is Isaac Arendt. Costly edifices of worship, costly decorations, costly dress, and costly equipage are all inimical to the humility and simplicity of the religion of Jesus. This was 1866. So he's lamenting the kind of the gentrification of worship. And I grew up worshiping in Kentucky, and it was not at all unreasonable to see farmers come to worship wearing their Sunday overalls. I mean, my grandfather got a new pair of overalls for Christmas every year. That was his Sunday overalls. And the ones that were getting worn out got in the everyday stack. And he never wore his Sunday overalls anywhere but church. They would wear it to Christmas dinner and things like that. But that was the prevailing attitude, that we didn't need to be imitating the world that was around us with all of the worldliness. We didn't need to be building a $140,000 beautiful edifice like they build in Cincinnati. And of course, the instrument was just associated with the edifice. There was one church that purchased a building that had a piano, or it had an organ in the building that they purchased. And they decided to move the organ downstairs. Somebody said there's nothing wrong with the church having an organ as long as it's not seen or heard. So they picked up the organ and moved it downstairs. They didn't get rid of it, but they moved it out of the assembly. This is another statement by Ben Franklin. Franklin was not one to mince words. He said, "We have no patience for this mere butterfly twaddle. Top loftical, air castle, highfalutin, and empty thing." I have no idea what the word top loftical even means. And I don't know why he would call it butterfly twaddle. I think it's just the way that they talked back then. So there's another part of this that's associated with the gentrification of the church. And this is kind of in keeping with what Ed Harrell put together in the paper that I sent you, that talks about the emergence of the Church of Christ denomination. Well, he's talking about the instrumental Church of Christ. And he says that it's a denomination because it tried to be like every other religious group that was around it. And he has a lot more examples that he talks about, but But he says this is part of the denomination type thinking. When we think about this, we usually think of it in terms of a name. Well, the name wasn't as important as a change in the culture and the church kind of moving uptown. Well, T.R. Burnett was one who argued vehemently against hired preachers. Happened at about the same time. So you had a division. This division wasn't an equal division. By far, most of the folks went with this denomination-inspired movement that eventually becomes the Disciples of Christ. About two-thirds of the entire population of the Stone Campbell movement went with the Disciples of Christ. They were mostly in the north. They were mostly the wealthy congregations, the places that had an economic base that gave them a lot more wealth. They were larger, and they supported, in general, missionary societies that we've seen already. They supported the use of instrumental music. They taught that silence, where the Bible does not speak, was permissive. If the Bible doesn't say don't do it, then it's okay to do it. They were the progressive thinkers of the day. And for them, they retained the idea that the unity of believers was the primary goal. Now remember, that's the way that Campbell and O'Kelly and Stone kind of began this movement, looking at issues around unity. The folks that left, the folks that I'm associated with, that we tend to be associated with, are known as the Churches of Christ. That division was kind of completed by the 1902 census. David Lipscomb was asked whether this division that people had begun to see was real, and he said yes, it was. There were two distinct groups, the Disciples of Christ and the Churches of Christ. And he focused on two really important factors. The Churches of Christ generally opposed the missionary society. They generally opposed instrumental music. Generally speaking, they saw silence as restrictive, where the disciples said, if God didn't talk about it, then we can do it. If God didn't prohibit, then we can do it. In the Churches of Christ, the argument was made that if God didn't say do it, we don't have the right to introduce it. It's kind of like, I've made the point before, it's kind of like the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Those rights that are not specifically delegated to the federal government remain the prerogative of the states. Well, this was the same thing. they tended to be, as I said, concentrated in the South, below the Mason-Dixon line. They tended to be much more rural, and they tended to be, for the most part, not nearly as wealthy. Now, there were exceptions to that. There were people in the South who were very wealthy. This is about the time that we began to use oil. And there were some Christians in Texas and Oklahoma and in places like that where they found oil on their land and they became immensely wealthy. But for the most part, churches in the South, in the rural parts of the country, did not have the economic base that you saw in the North. They tended to be apocalyptic. They tended to think in terms of the end of the world. And for them, unity was not the main goal. The main goal was to restore the church to what God intended it to be, a church that we saw in the very earliest days of the book of Acts. So their goals are different. And those goals are, in the future, we're going to see that they pull farther apart. This is another chart that kind of illustrates the same thing. This chart will give you a bit more of the numbers when the division happened in 1906. The group that was the Christian church or the Disciples of Christ, 982,000 members. The Churches of Christ had 159,000. So if you work that out, a large percentage of the descendants of the Stone Campbell movement went with the Christian church in 1906. And I think that probably holds true today. Those people in the Disciples of Christ or the Christian Church or those folks that use an instrument that may call themselves Church of Christ, they would refer to themselves as mainline churches. And those who oppose the instrument, oppose the American Christian Missionary Society, and we'll see later who opposed the building of institutions that, generally speaking, arose around taking care of orphans. They were much smaller. And to the mainstream Church of Christ, those, myself included, are referred to as antis. And that some of that plays out in the attitude that pervades this sort of side of the movement. That we argue against things. We never argue for things. And I think we have to learn to get beyond that. We have to learn to say what we're for. We can't just be against things. So that ends our discussion for tonight. Any questions or comments? Does this ring true with your experience? You know, we're getting up close enough to a time period where these are things that are not so far behind us that we don't think about them.
Dean?
Yeah.
When you're talking about the instrument, and if the instrument is the heart, you're not, you're, even though you're against a mechanical instrument, you are for the instrument of the heart. So, I mean, in the argument, you are pro something. You're not just anti.
Right. Absolutely. And it's an unfortunate aspect of our preaching that we tend to say that we're, we never define ourselves as non, we tend to define ourselves, excuse me, as non-instrumental. We never define ourselves as a group that loves to sing, that loves a cappella music. And that, you know, that's a disservice, I think. And I am very pro a cappella music. I love a cappella music. I really do. I tell you that to me, a lot of modern music sounds to my ear very discordant. It's based on clashes. Jazz is that way. Jazz is kind of a discordant, kind of abrasive kind of music to my ear. I really enjoy a cappella music. And if it's music, I really enjoy it. Just an acoustic guitar. That's me. I don't like the electric guitar and all of the riffs. And so when I think about music in church, the discordant music doesn't fit with my image of a God who is one of harmony. Now, that's not a scriptural argument. That's just my feeling. The biblical argument does revolve around how we sing, what our instrument is, and that comes from 1 Corinthians 14.